So how long after Adam and Eve were in the Garden of Eden did they sin? How long after then God had given them that command not to eat of the tree did they eat then of that forbidden fruit? Well, you can read commentaries and theologians, and some of them will speculate on that. And I think if you read those, you learn more about the character of the authors of those works than you do about the actual time that elapsed between the command and the sin. Those of a more pessimistic bent will say it was probably only a few minutes or hours before Adam ate that fruit. And those who are more optimistic would say, oh, it was probably weeks and months that they served the Lord there before they sinned. Well, the scripture doesn't tell us the answer to that particular question, I think. But it does tell us how long it was before Nadab and Abihu sinned and were consumed by fire, as we read at the beginning of Leviticus chapter 10. Because we did read a little earlier, a little later in chapter 10, that as Aaron replied, he said, behold, in verse 19, behold, today they have offered their sin offering, their burnt offering before the Lord. And yet such things have happened to me. So these things then, the immolation of Nadab and Abihu, took place on the very same day as those offerings that we were reading of in chapter 9. That they, as the priesthood led by Aaron, had offered these sacrifices. They had seen the great blessing. They had worshipped as they fell on their faces, as the Lord manifested his holiness, his glory amongst them. And then within, it seemed, just a few hours, that very same day then, they sinned and were themselves consumed by that fire. And my link to the Garden of Eden, as you may remember, is a deliberate one, because the tabernacle we've seen and the temple later were an earthly copy of the original Garden of Eden. And that's why then I've chose to make that, because I think we're meant to see a failure here that replicates the failure in the Garden of Eden. Adam and Eve, we don't know exactly how long it was, but here very quickly, after then this earthly copy of the Garden of Eden, which itself was heaven on earth, after then this has been consecrated and the holy worship has begun. So soon after then, do these priests of all people sin and bring the wrath of God against themselves? And I guess, as we've said, Leviticus to many of us is not a very familiar book. And if you were asked about Leviticus and what you know about it, then you might talk about the cleanliness and all those funny rules and regulations we'll come to, God willing, next week. But you might also remember this incident. This incident when these two priests then were burned up by the Lord's fire. And you might remember it as one of a sequence of incidents in the Pentateuch and through the Old Testament. Incidents which lead some people to say, well, you know, wasn't this God of yours? Wasn't he a very temperamental God then? Wasn't he a bit unstable? And didn't he seem to kind of lash out so easily? And he sets in place then this terribly complex sets of rules and regulations, then, you know, you just step out of line a little bit and whack, you know, he punishes you like this. There are plagues bursting forth on people in the wilderness, we read. Thousands of men and women consumed, dying by these plagues. We read later of Korah's rebellion. The earth opens up and swallows these men and women in their families. We read of the Lord's fire bursting forth and burning a whole bunch of men there as they had come to offer their incense in that rebellion. And it doesn't end with the Pentateuch, does it? There's Uzzah later on, you know, just touching, it seems. It's such a trivial thing, we might think. Just touching it, and he's struck down as he just touches the ark in the days of David as they were bringing it, celebrating to Jerusalem. And it's incidents like this then that can lead people, and do lead people, to have a kind of wrong view, of course, of the Lord as this kind of unstable, temperamental deity, and the claims then of some that he's just different from the God of the New Testament and so on. And we all know how wrong that is, of course. We know that in the New Testament we read that we're to work out our salvation with fear and trembling. It's in the New Testament that we read that we're receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, and we're to offer God worship with reverence and awe because he is a consuming fire. It's in the New Testament in Acts 5 that Ananias and Sapphira are struck down. It's in the New Testament in 1 Corinthians 11 that we read of people there in the Corinthian church being struck down with sickness and dying for their sins. In the book of Revelation, the earth, these churches at the beginning, we read again of the Lord afflicting people in that way. We're not worshipping any different God. We're worshipping the same God, a God who is like this. And a God who then, as we've seen in the New Testament, continues like this. But then, of course, it's selective, isn't it, this approach, remembering these incidents, the fire bursting out, the plagues, the earth opening up and so on. It's selective. If we read properly, we just read through the Pentateuch, then many of you will probably feel like me, amazed at how patient the Lord is with his sinful people. We read time after time of how ungrateful they are. Time after time of how repeatedly they sin against him, not just through the Pentateuch and the wilderness wanderings, but on and on through the Old Testament. Generation after generation, how they provoke him with their idol worship and their gross immorality, their flagrant injustice and so on, as we've been reading in Amos. We read all this and we're amazed, at least I am, at the amazing patience of the Lord. That these incidents of the fire breaking out, as it did here on Nadab and Abihu, I think stand out because they're exceptional. He is a God of justice, a holy Lord who punishes, but there is so much more that we're told, of course, about his character through the Old Testament. And it's selective then also in Leviticus chapter 10, isn't it? Just to kind of remember Nadab and Abihu is to miss the complementary episode at the end of the chapter. Look at verses 16 and following. Moses then diligently inquired about the goat of the sin offering, and behold, it was burned up. And he was angry with Eleazar and Itamar, the surviving sons of Aaron, saying, "Why have you not eaten the sin offering in the place of the sanctuary? Since it is a thing most holy, and it's been given to you that you may bear the iniquity of the congregation, to make atonement for them before the Lord. Behold, its blood was not brought into the inner part of the sanctuary. You certainly ought to have eaten it in the sanctuary as I commanded." So here we have Eleazar and Itamar. They too have broken the rules for sanctuary worship. But I suspect most of you didn't notice that there was no outburst of fire on this occasion. There was no holy fire consuming these two sons of Aaron. Noticing things which aren't there is always tricky, isn't it? As many of you know, I often travel down to London with work, and usually when I'm travelling down, I reflect on terrorism and whether, you know, there's going to be bombs going off and so on in London. And yet, since July the 7th in 2005, there haven't been, have there? Many of you remember, aren't, that in July 2005, there were four bombs set off by Islamist terrorists, which killed 52 people in London and injured many others. We've now been over 10 years since, and we have not had a repeat of such atrocities, have we? It's a classic case of no news is good news, isn't it? Yes, there have been horrible atrocities elsewhere in France and Turkey and so on, but we are blessed we have not had a repetition in this country. And it's easy then to miss that fact, isn't it? And we should be grateful for it. But you see, my point then, no news is good news, but we tend to miss it and not notice it. And the no news here, the no news story is at the end of Leviticus 10, if you like. That there was not the outburst of the Lord's fire to consume Eleazar and Itamar as there had been earlier that day with their brothers. And we have then this chapter, Leviticus 10, is bookmarked by these two episodes, isn't it? On each occasion we have two sons of Aaron, two priests. On each occasion these two priests, they break the rules for how they should be worshipping the Lord in his sanctuary. And on the first occasion, they're consumed with fire. But on the second occasion, nothing, as it were, happens. And I think, therefore, we can learn more important lessons about the Lord as we compare and contrast these two episodes, as I think we're meant to do as we read Leviticus chapter 10. Yes, our attention is easily drawn to the spectacular immolation of the elder brothers Nadab and Abihu, but we learn lessons as we contrast this then with the other two, the younger brothers, Eleazar and Itamar. So let's consider them in turn. First of all then, Nadab and Abihu. What did they do? What did they do then that provoked the Lord's wrath? Well, we read in chapter 10, don't we, at the beginning, verses 1 and 2. Now Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, each took his censer and put fire in it and laid incense on it and offered unauthorized fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. The footnote in the ESV is strange fire, as other translations do. They offer this strange fire. But the key thing about it is clearly in the repetition, isn't it? That it was fire which the Lord had not commanded them to offer. And this was why they were consumed. Now, we might think, I suppose, that it doesn't seem to be much of a big deal, failing to offer exactly as the Lord had commanded, bringing something that he hadn't authorised, that he hadn't commanded. But as you read, and as we've read through the chapters of Leviticus, you'll have seen the refrain about what the Lord has commanded, verse after verse, with that refrain, as the Lord commanded Moses, as the Lord commanded Moses. It's a great drumbeat that goes through this whole book. And if we just go back through the consecration chapters in chapter 8 and 9, so verse 4 we have, Moses did as the Lord commanded him. Verse 5, this is the thing that the Lord has commanded to be done. Verse 9, he put on the holy crown as the Lord commanded Moses. Verse 13, as the Lord commanded Moses. Verse 17, as the Lord commanded Moses. Verse 21, as the Lord commanded Moses. Verse 29, as the Lord commanded Moses. Verse 34, the Lord has commanded to be done today. Verse 36, as the Lord commanded Moses. Into chapter 9, it continues. 9 verse 6, the thing that the Lord has commanded you to do. Verse 7, as the Lord has commanded. Verse 10, as the Lord commanded Moses. Verse 21, as the Lord commanded. And so when we reach chapter 10 and verse 1, and it says, he had not commanded them, it should jump out at us. Here it has been, as the Lord has commanded, as the Lord has commanded, as the Lord has commanded. And suddenly, here are these priests doing something which God has not commanded. It's been spelled out to them. It's been so clear to everyone that everything in the sanctuary worship was to be exactly as God commanded. And then these two priests just take it upon themselves to make up their own rules, to decide how to do it themselves in a way that had not been commanded. This was the essence of their transgression. We learn a little more of it if you just flick forwards to chapter 16. So chapter 16, the beginning of that chapter, on the Day of Atonement. And in the opening verses then of chapter 16 we read, so we're still in history on the same day. The Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron, when they drew near before the Lord and died. And the Lord said to Moses, tell Aaron your brother not to come at any time into the holy place inside the veil before the mercy seat that's on the ark, that he may not die. For I will appear, for I appear in the cloud over the mercy seat. So it seems that part of the gross sin then of Nadab and Abihu was that they went into that most holy place. That they had broken those barriers that we looked at previously when we reflected on the structure of this book. That there were zones of cleanliness and holiness, and the most holy place at the heart of the whole worship system, where the Ark of the Covenant was and the Lord came to live amongst his people. Only the high priest was to go there, only on that Day of Atonement. But Nadab and Abihu, in their gross presumption, had just taken it upon themselves to come and offer their own kind of worship in that place. And so you see, the sin of Nadab and Abihu was not some trivial thing. The sin of Nadab and Abihu was not just a little stepping out of line. It wasn't some kind of accidental happening. It wasn't just a mistake. No, they knew that worship was to be as authorized by God. As we've seen, it was drilled into them all. They knew worship had to be done as God says it is to be done. But they still just took it upon themselves to worship as they saw best. And they knew that that innermost place behind the veil was out of bounds even for them. But they just decided, well, if they wanted to go in there and take their incense in there, then so be it. So their sin then, as I say, isn't a little thing. It's not an accidental failing. This isn't the Lord bursting out because they've just done some tiny little thing wrong. No, they have brazenly gone and worshipped God in their own way and gone into the most holy place of all, where they were not permitted to go. And that is why they were struck down. That is why they were immolated by the fire of the Lord. And what does it say then about the attitude of these men, Nadab and Abihu? If you think on what I said then about what they did, what does it say about their attitude to the Lord and his worship? Well, I suggest it shows us that they had a low view of the Lord, that they didn't have a high, reverent and holy view of their God. That in spite of everything that they had been taught, in spite of all the experiences that they had had of the Lord in his awesome greatness, delivering Israel and so on from Egypt, they did not have that holy and reverent fear that worshippers of God ought to have. Because it was, I think, an absence of that reverence for God that would make sense of why they would behave in this way, of why they would just think, well, it doesn't really matter how we worship him. It doesn't really matter about all his rules and regulations. It doesn't really matter if only Aaron is ever allowed and only once a year into that sanctuary place. But of course it does matter. It matters very much that they so flagrantly, high-handedly transgressed, and that their attitude then was so poor towards the Lord. Reverent fear then, holy fear, should characterise godly worship as it characterised the Israelites. At the end of chapter 9, we read them shouting, falling on their faces. This is joyful worship of the Lord. He is amongst them and they're celebrating that great privilege. But he is the consuming fire, as the writer in Hebrews reminds us. Godly worship then has that mixture of awe, reverence for God, and joy in his presence. It is joy mingled with holy fear. You have then a pupil, I'm not supposed to call them pupils anymore, students at school, and the student then is told that she's got to go and see the headmistress, the principal headmistress of the school. And initially, you know, she's a bit worried about this, thinking, you know, what have I done wrong that I'm being asked to go to the office of the principal of the school? But then her teacher reassures her, no, don't worry, it's not because you've done anything wrong. Not because you've done anything wrong. It's she wants to thank you personally for all your hard work and how well you've been doing your schoolwork. So how then does that young girl approach the office of a headmistress? Well, of course it's the headmistress in authority over them, over authority over her, and with all that power. And so she should have and would have that fear, that awe, as she approaches the office. But at the same time, she can approach with a joy, a happiness in her heart, can't she? Because she knows it's not because she's not going to be punished. She's not going to have anything bad said about her. She's going to be thanked and praised. Or you think of a boss. Think of a chief executive, a boss in an organisation. And he does a fantastic job. He's awesome in the modern sense. He's awesome in the way he does his job. He's talented. He's diligent. He's really effective. He makes decisions that are wise, that enable the company to grow and expand. He runs the ship, as it were, his workplace effectively. There is strong discipline when people go astray, but people like working there, inspired by his example and by his powerful and wise leadership. And there you are, working for him in this company, and you're summoned to his office. And again, like the little girl, you might think, oh no, you know, what's going to happen? Have I done something wrong? But again, you know, somebody says, no, don't worry, I think he wants to talk to you about a promotion or a pay rise or something. And so again, how would you go? Well, you would go, this inspirational, powerful leader, you would go with a sense of some trepidation, some sense of awe and fear, but you would also go with happiness, with joy in your heart, because you know the purpose for which you're going. And the right approach to worship then is like these examples I've tried to sketch out, isn't it? Yes, there has to be that awe, because we worship the God of the universe. We worship the sovereign ruler of the skies, as we've just been singing, the one who holds the whole universe in his hands. And nothing happens in this universe that he has not commanded and brought to pass. What an awesome God we worship. But we worship him then as his covenant people. We worship him as those who have been loved and redeemed in Jesus Christ. We come to worship him joyfully. We come as a happy and holy people. This is how we should come to worship. It's not how Nadab and Abby who came. They came disrespecting God. And therefore they felt free to just make the rules up themselves. And then at the end of the chapters we've read, we have this contrast, don't we? These two other sons, these two brothers, Eleazar and Itamar. And they too break the rules. That's very clear, isn't it? They break the rules. They had offered these various offerings, as we read, for the people. And for the people's sin offering, then it was to be dealt with in a slightly different way from the priesthood's sin offering. That sin offering, a purification offering, it did not have the blood sprinkled into the most holy place. And therefore, we read in chapter 6 that how it was to be dealt with differently. It was not to be burned on the altar of burnt offering, but portions of it would be eaten by the priesthood. And that's why we read then of Moses' words when he says, its blood in verse 18, its blood was not brought into the inner part of the sanctuary. He's saying, you know what kind of offering this was. It was a people's purification offering. Its blood was not sprinkled in the inner sanctuary, and therefore you know you should have eaten it. What is more, of course, as we've read, Moses spelled this out to them, didn't he? He told them earlier on in the chapter that they were to take it and eat it. And he says then again at the end of verse 18, you certainly ought to have eaten it in the sanctuary as I commanded. But what did they do? Well, Moses, when he inquired, as we read in verse 16, found that they'd burned it up. They had burned it on the altar of burnt offering instead. So let's look at the context then for these two men. Like their brothers, formally they have broken the rules, but they're not consumed. So earlier in the chapter, we read then, of course, of their grief, but we read of the fact that they're not allowed to mourn. We read this in verses 4 to 7. Moses says in verse 6 to Aaron and Eleazar and Itamar, do not let the hair of your heads hang loose, and do not tear your clothes lest you die, and the wrath come upon all the congregation. But let your brothers, the whole house of Israel, bewail the burning that the Lord has kindled. And do not go outside the entrance of the tent of meeting, lest you die. For the anointing oil of the Lord is upon you. And then we read, and they did according to the word of the Lord. So here we have these two men and Aaron. But these two brothers, their brothers have just been consumed by fire. They're not machines. They're in pain. They're grieving. They're shocked at the great loss of their brothers. Their older brothers have now died. They want to mourn the loss of their brothers. They want to exercise that natural human response to the death of their brothers. But they're not allowed to. They're specifically prohibited, as we've read. They're not allowed to tear their clothes and let their hair go loose and so on. The mourning rituals of Israelites. And they're not even allowed to go out from the sanctuary area to meet with anybody else where they might receive comfort and consolation from wider family members and friends who might comfort and console them in their grief. And they obey, don't they? They keep these difficult commands that they're given. In their grief, then, they do what the Lord has said through Moses. But then, as we've seen, they're also to eat this offering. And they can't bring themselves to do that. It's one thing to not leave the sanctuary and to not go through that external grieving process, tearing their clothes and so on. But it's another to eat the food in joyful worship when their hearts are filled with grief and pain. They can't bring themselves to do this. But as we've seen, they are those who will obey the Lord. They will not go and grieve. They will not leave the sanctuary. And they don't just ignore the meat and let it rot. They don't chuck it away. They burn it up. They dispose of it in the best possible way that they could do. If it had been another kind of sin offering, as I say, then they would have burned it on the altar. So it was a kind of appropriate way of dealing with that meat when they didn't want to eat it. And so this is Aaron's justification, isn't it? Today, he says, behold, today we've offered these things. We've made these offerings before the Lord. But the things that have happened, obviously referring to the death of Nadab and Abihu, the things that have happened, if I, and he's speaking, of course, for the sons on their behalf, if we'd eaten this food, would the Lord have approved? And Moses, as it were, speaking on the Lord's behalf, says, you know, he approved. When Moses heard that, he approved. The implication is the Lord has at some level approved because he has not consumed them with fire. There's something very different here from Nadab and Abihu, isn't there? These men, these priests, they revere the Lord. They maintain the holy standards because the anointing oil's on them. They do not go through the grieving process and so on. It's just that they can't fake joyful worship, and they know it. They can't pretend that they're full of joy now in their worship of the Lord as they eat this meal, when their hearts are filled with grief at the loss of their brothers. And of course, the Lord sees this great difference in their hearts. The Lord knows then why they can't do it. As Aaron says, these things have happened. Would the Lord have been pleased if we'd come and kind of forced ourselves to eat this meat? Pretending? No, of course he wouldn't have done, they say. So yes, formally they've transgressed, they've broken the rules. But we see in this contrast then, in these two episodes, don't we, different aspects of the character of God. Nadab and Abihu, their wickedness was flagrant, it was high-handed, it was premeditated, it was deliberate, and it was based on a low view, a trivial view of God, no reverence, no fear. Their brothers, Eleazar and Itamar, though, have a very different approach, a very different attitude. They want to honour the Lord. They don't want to be hypocrites. They maintain what they can, but they can't manage the fullness of joyful worship, eating that celebratory meal together. The Lord is merciful and kind. That's, of course, how he spoke of himself when he met with Moses back in Exodus, wasn't it? And Moses said, show me your glory. And the Lord described himself then as a God who is gracious and compassionate, a God who is merciful and kind, a God who delights in showing such love to, as it were, 1,000 generations. He's a God like this. But yes, he says, he's also a God who punishes iniquity. It's much less strength of that. It's just a third and fourth generation. But he will deal with iniquity, as he does with Nadab and Abihu, with their high-handed sin. But he is a God of mercy. He's a God of kindness. He sees these men. And so he withholds. He won't afflict them. He understands and is merciful towards their failure, their transgression in worship. And so you can see how all this then, when we properly look at Leviticus 10, how it gives us a very much more rounded and accurate view of the character of God. If we just get caught up with the immolation of Nadab and Abihu, we can end up with this distorted view of a capricious God, a God with a big stick who's just looking for us to step out of line and whack us. But this isn't God. This isn't our God. Yes, holy and awesome to be feared, but a God who is merciful and compassionate. He understands us in our weakness. He understood the grief and the pain then of Eleazar and Itamar. And so he did not punish them as their sin deserved. He was merciful and kind because he's a merciful, kind and gracious God. And so we see then three key elements in worship, briefly as we close, don't we? We see that true worship of the Lord has then this proper attitude. A holy fear, that is a reverent fear mingled with joy as we come to worship God. It's a proper attitude, and that leads then to a proper approach to God. An approach that says, I want to follow his rules. I want to follow his regulations. I want to worship him as he tells me to worship him. I'm not going to make it up myself. And it leads to the proper aim in worship, which is to glorify his name. That's what we read in verse 3, isn't it? The Lord says, this is what the Lord has said. Among those who are near me, I will be sanctified, and before all the people, I will be glorified. Nadab and Abihu, with their wrong attitude, their wrong approach, therefore, to worship, did not aim at glorifying God. So he glorified himself in their immolation. He will be glorified, but he wants to be glorified through a proper attitude. Holy, joyful fear of him. And a proper approach then that says, how does God tell us he should be worshipped? And so we come then with a proper attitude and approach to glorify him through each and every aspect of our worship. That's our desire. I hope every Lord's Day, morning and evening, that God's name would be glorified in this place as we come with a proper attitude and a proper approach to his worship. Amen. So we close with number 54. Hymn number 54 then, a hymn which takes up some of those themes then that we've just been reflecting on about the greatness of God, the omnipotent one, ruling the universe, our smallness in his sight. And yet we sing this with joy as we worship him together.